Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we talk to the inventor of the Newbrella, a modern take on the classic umbrella. We find out about a new website based in Urbana called Book Glutton that combines an e-library with a social networking site. We hear about some Appalachian hip-hop and a modern-day cowboy's ride across America. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Appalachian music is homespun music, played in people's homes and passed down through generations. In Atlanta, a group called Rising Appalachia is made up of two women in their 20s whose parents played this traditional music and taught it to their daughters. These young women have added their own Atlanta hip-hop edge to bring Appalachian music into the 21st century. More now from independent producer Marianne Gardner.
Singing and making music come naturally for sisters Chloe and Leah Smith. Chloe, 23, the younger sister, handles herself with grace and maturity. She plays the fiddle mainly, and also the banjo, thumb piano, and harmonizes with her sister.
The music that we play is special to me because it is both a family tradition and our own creative exploration in modern music.
Their exploration results in country music with an urban edge. This isn't country with a bonnet and a quilt, but country with a tattoo and an attitude. Leah's attitude shows in her hair, which she describes as a dreadlock, mullet, mohawk. Creativity runs in the family. Their fiddling mother and folk sculpting father took the girls for music and dance weekends in the Appalachian Mountains when they were growing up. Leah feels that.
The Appalachian culture that I think is really endearing to me is that it's very much a front porch music. It's a poor music. It's the music that was used to tell stories and pass down history.
This music that beats like the heart of America often filters from the Smiths' Candler Park front porch. Although their parents, Jan and Andy Smith, aren't from Appalachia, they play that music and invite the neighbors. But Lee and Chloe didn't always appreciate their parents' love for this music.
Our parents would oftentimes have living room dance music jam parties, during which Leah and I would promptly sneak out the window and run down the street to hip-hop clubs.
Leah, 26, likes the groove element in hip-hop because...
We pull in a lot of bass. It drops you into your hips a little bit.
Here's a piece of music from their new CD.
We play a modern, rowdy, rhythmic, world fusion, old-time music. And my mother and a number of other people play it straightforward.
Their mother, Jan, takes up her fiddle and plays a tune called Sail Away Ladies in a traditional style. And Chloe and Leah's rendition is almost unrecognizable from the original. Tunes passed down through generations stretch and flex to suit the voice of the singer. Chloe listens to the history behind American Appalachian music and finds her own way to make the music and sing the song.
It's sort of our duty to both pass it along and to encourage its publicity in the world, to say, and yet to change it and add some more modern and original takes on these old tunes, just so that maybe some young people are exposed to it.
This is Marianne Gardner.
This is Sidetrack. As the presidential candidates travel from state to state, shaking hands and kissing babies, a different kind of candidate is recovering from a similar cross-country adventure. But instead of a campaign bus, he rides a horse. And he's not really campaigning for anything in particular. Independent producer Jen Nathan has more.
It's a chilly gray morning in Hendersonville, North Carolina. 40 people and half a dozen horses stand shivering in an asphalt parking lot. This is a rare place to meet a celebrity.
I'm just thrilled to be here. Really excited.
I didn't know if we'd get a parking spot.
But this is a historic moment.
It is.
It's not Barack Obama or even Brad Pitt they're waiting to meet. It's a man named Bill Inman.
It started off with a small idea and then kind of grew and grew. You just don't wake up one morning and go, oh, I just think I'll just take a horse and go across the United States.
But that's exactly what Bill did. 7 months ago, he left his home in Lebanon, Oregon, and headed east on his horse, Blackie. Today, he's getting Blackie ready for the last 12 miles of the 2,900-mile trip.
Well, I'm putting his bridle on. It's kind of like your steering wheel. We've got saddles, and he's all ready to go. You know, I know there's a crowd waiting for us over there, and they're going to have fried chicken, and people want to be a part of the deal. We're having a big dinner down there at the Schroeder's Honda since it's a big parking lot.
Like a candidate on the campaign trail or someone on a PR tour, Bill has more than one stop to make today. He's invited anyone with a road-ready horse to meet him 4 miles up the road from the Honda dealership to ride beside him for the last leg of the trip. But so far, more people than horses have shown up, and they're starting to get restless.
I'm anxious to see this horse.
How long have you been here waiting?
Oh, about an hour now. Wait, this is long. I got to see this horse.
I don't know many people have done it, do you? So I think maybe one day he'll be famous. I hope. So that's why we're down here, to see it.
Would you like to do something like that someday, right across the country?
Yeah, because I'd get noticed more, and I'd get famous and have a lot more people know me.
Have you met Bill yet?
No, ma'am.
Are you excited to?
Yes, ma'am.
The crowd, which has grown to nearly 60 people, has heard a lot about Bill.
Oh, I've been following it in the newspaper.
Saw it on the news when it first started.
Read it in the newspaper.
More than 20 newspapers, including the Associated Press, have followed Bill's seven-month journey. His wife, whose initial job was to drive ahead in the horse trailer and set up camp, has become a makeshift PR person. Nearly every mile of the trip has been documented by independent filmmaker Dallas Pizzola. And Bill's son, Jonathan Campos, came along to post videos to Bill's website. Yes, the man riding his horse across the country has a website. Maybe this is the true embodiment of the American dream, to bask in the cult of celebrity in every small town across America.
Would you have done this trip if people hadn't paid attention, if it was just you on your horse alone?
The journey wasn't to be just me and the horse. It was all about something that people would come see. You know, what we want to do is profile, you know, some of the people that never get recognized, like Hall of Fame cowboys and, you know, Hall of Famers or elderly people.
Bill's been given free dinners, met mayors, and even received gifts from little old ladies by the side of the road.
A lady said, hey, Bill, here's a little cross, and hopefully it'll bring some sunshine, some good luck. So I put the cross in my pocket, and I always never had more than $5 in my pocket. And all of a sudden, I got 20s. And now look, see, I still got 40, and I still got the cross.
Bill has plenty of tall tales like this one, and he says people from all over the world have read about them on his website.
The simplest things, like my wife cooking cowboy cornbread. We filmed it. 200 people were cooking cowboy cornbread in India. I get emails from China. I get emails from Iraq.
But the trip hasn't been all cornbread, emails, and photo shoots. Bill and Blackie have hit some rough patches along the way.
We had problems with the weather. We had problems with topography, altitude, about everything.
Including loneliness.
You don't have anybody to talk to. And you're like, you know, I've been doing this for 4 days and I haven't even seen a house.
But Bill didn't give up. He likens a journey like this to swimming halfway across a river.
Well, what are you going to do? Turn around and swim back? Might as well just go ahead. It's just as far going forward as it is going back. Just point him east and ride another 20 miles and see what that changes.
Maybe this is why people have been so fascinated with his story.
Most Americans show up at work, sit at their desks, and do pretty much the same thing day after day. But Bill's taken a big risk, and for the most part, it's paid off.
It is the toughest thing I've ever done in my life, the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life.
And this is the most famous Bill has ever been in his life. As a ranch hand, an Army helicopter pilot, or the owner of a range management business, Bill hasn't gotten a lot of media attention before this. He hasn't been fazed by it during his trip, but he admits he hasn't always liked sharing the fame either.
Yeah, he's a special horse. I think he's more well-known than I am, because I've had people pull over and go, "Is that horse named Blackie?" They don't say, "Is your name Bill?" You know what I mean? We have national reporters asking, "How does Blackie like his name spelled, with an I, E, or a Y?" It'll probably happen today.
I just want to see Blackie. I want to see him take off on the last part of his ride.
Off in the distance, a man in a cowboy hat and a dusty trench coat slowly becomes larger. The crowd moves to the edge of the parking lot, watching as Bill passes by a gas station and a Chinese buffet, until finally...
Hey! Hello, sir.
Thank you. It's an honor. Ma'am.
After shaking hands, giving autographs, and even posing with the baby, Bill rounds up the 13 horseback riders here to join him for the last 4 miles of the trip. Across town, a different crowd is gathered at a new parking lot, ready to greet Bill at his final destination. Family and friends gather round long tables, piled high with fried chicken and homemade German chocolate cake. With his horse, his wife, and his filmmaker by his side, Bill is happy to share today's limelight.
Everybody, this is my mom.
In Hendersonville, North Carolina, I'm Jen Nathan.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Ebooks have been around for a while, but for whatever reason, they really haven't caught on. Two people in Urbana, Travis Alber and Aaron Miller, are hoping to change that. They have just launched a website called Book Glutton, found online at bookglutton.com, that combines an ebook library with a social networking site. I talked to them recently and asked them first to explain what Book Glutton is. Alber took the first question.
Bookglutton.com is a cross between a social network and a book. And our original intent was to allow people to both read online and to be able to discuss the book inside the book itself.
Well, Aaron, how did this get started?
We were sitting around at the Esquire talking about reading books and reading books online in particular, and just remarking on the fact that there was no real good way to do it that we could see, and especially not one that took advantage of all of the features of the web, which would be, you know, being connected to your friends, being able to chat, email, sharing annotations, things like that. And that's just kind of how we came up with the idea.
I could also add that Aaron and I tend to read a lot of the same books, but not at the same time. So it's really nice to be able to talk to people who are reading the same thing and remark on things rather than waiting a year to discuss it with somebody else.
It's the old book club, the intimacy of a book club.
Exactly.
Now, this site has only been going since mid-January, is that correct?
Yeah, it's brand new.
Wow. And how's it going so far? What's the membership like? What type of books do you have available?
Well, it's going well. We have steadily increasing membership, the real good thing for us is that we have a core of the community that comes back to the site regularly, and we have some users that are in there daily, which is really good for a site that's just launched. It's good to have those hardcore members in there, It's kind of a niche community, basically. It's not only people who like books, which are a rarity in today's society, but it's people who like books and like to read them on the computer, or would be open-minded enough to do that and want to do it with other people. So given that, it's going well.
Most of our books right now are public domain, meaning that they're out of copyright, but we're just about to launch an upload tool so that anyone who comes to the site will be able to upload their own work and share it with others. And in the future, we hope to partner with some publishers to offer more contemporary work.
What's the audience? Who are you trying to reach out to?
Well, we're trying to reach anybody who likes to read, obviously. But some of the early adapters have been librarians, teachers, people involved with book groups. And we hope that'll grow to people who are just looking for other people to connect with who like to read the same things.
Now, this idea of e-books, it's been around for quite a while, and it's always been problematic. And the complaint is always, it's too hard to look at a screen, there's no attention span. How do you guys work against those problems?
Well, I think people are becoming more and more used to using their laptop. If you walk into any coffee shop, you always see people multitasking on their computers. They use it as a communication device, an information tool to check the weather. And so I think that barrier is being broken down slowly. I also think it's partially an aesthetics issue. A lot of the ebook reading software that's been built before on the internet didn't really pay a lot of attention to how the user felt about the book, how it looked, how it was to use, and those things tend to be really important if you want somebody to adapt a new way to do something.
And how does your software address that issue?
Well, a couple different ways. Actually, Aaron, do you want to take that question?
Oh, all right. From the very beginning, we paid a lot of attention to the user experience and the way it looks, and we didn't want to try to replicate what a book is exactly, but we wanted to pay attention to the things that people really love about books, like typography, drop caps, images, turning a page instead of scrolling through a page, the size and the layout of the page. Things like that matter to people, and they were severely lacking or just kind of not paid enough attention to in the kinds of software that was available to read books in. You either have your desktop applications that you download and you install, and they're full of digital rights management software that can get really screwy and screw up your system. Or you go online and you read a book on a website and you scroll through, hundreds of pages in one document. And it's just seems like nobody's really given it a lot of thought yet. So we wanted to do that.
Well, the thing is that I do like about it, because I've gone on your website, I've looked around, is that it kind of looks like a paperback in the way that it is presented on the page. And you just, as you said, you flip through the pages and it looks like you're just reading a paperback on your computer screen. But I guess that gets me to the fundamental question. How do books and the art of reading work in the YouTube generation when your attention span is only a couple of minutes to most internet users?
Well, I think that's where the community comes in. One of the most unique things about BookLutton.com is the ability to chat inside different chapters or within the whole book itself with other people who are currently reading the same book. So you get to have that social networking connection that the younger generation is expecting. But you can also close that off if you just want to read by yourself. Also, the social annotations that you can make and share with other people by clicking on any paragraph, for example, you can click on the paragraph, leave yourself a note or a question, and someone else can come through the book and respond to that. That's a really powerful social event that you don't see, and you certainly can't get that in a paper book.
So do you guys still read plain old paper books?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Has having this website changed that to you, or is that something you guys want to change? I mean, do you want people to change their actual reading habits from something physical, a book, a paperback, whatever, to just on the computer screen?
Well, I think that inevitably more and more people are going to read online, but I don't think the paper book is going anywhere. There'll always be something to be said for curling up with a book in front of a fireplace. What we do want to do is probably get away from reading the 300-page PDF on your computer, because that, to me, is not an immersive or pleasant experience.
Yeah, I mean, we never wanted to replace paper books. We did this because we love paper books, and we wanted to extend that idea and create a kind of companion for them. We one of the things we said when we came up with the idea was, wouldn't it be nice if you owned a book and your friend owned the book, but your friend could be in another country and you could still sort of read the book and discuss it at a paragraph level together, because you had an electronic version of it that you were sharing, and so. That was one of the goals of this, was just take something that you love, that you already have in a physical form, and create a companion to it in digital form that you can then share with everyone else who's kind of tapped into the digital community.
So what's next for Book Glutton? Where do you want to go from here?
Well, acquiring more content is the biggest issue right now. We want to offer a lot more for people to read and discuss.
Yeah, content is a big step, and it's a hurdle because publishers are interested in getting books online in digital form, but they have a lot of reservations about it. There's digital rights management. There's concerns about piracy. There are format concerns.
Financial concerns. People need to get
definitely
paid.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, one of the things that made MP3s take off and the whole iTunes phenomenon was the format itself, MP3, which was a standard format for music files that actually sounded good, and it was important that it sounded good, and right now we're lacking an ebook format that lets people read books that look good. There are a lot of different proprietary formats, but we need a standard to move forward.
So are you guys thinking you might become the iTunes of ebooks?
That would be great.
That would be nice.
So if people want to see Book Glutton, sign up and chat about books with other people, where do they go and how do they do it?
You just go to bookglutton.com, and you can actually look around the site without even signing up. You can find a book on the search page and click on it and go in and read it. But to really get the full community features of the website, you should just sign up. The account's free, and it only takes about 2 minutes.
That was Travis Alber and Aaron Miller, the creators of Book Glutton. They can be found online at bookglutton.com. Thank you. listening to Sidetrack. Comic book conventions, better known as Comic Cons, are a haven for comic collectors of all sorts. The con is where enthusiasts gather to debate, sell, buy, and trade comics. But to an outsider, they are a strange collection of people in costumes who seem to live in a world of their own. With help of independent producer Zach Rosen, Detroit comic book writer Marty Herchak takes us on an audio tour of people you'll meet at these cons.
Hi, folks. I'm Marty Herchak, comics guru and all-around good guy. Well, enough about me. Let's get a move on. The Comic Con season is about to hit, and there's no time like now to get hip and figure out all the angles on the way-out comic book scene. A comic book convention has more to offer than a three-ring circus. Artists, writers, actors, pinup queens, t-shirts, TV and movie custom cars, a plethora of posters, action figures, toys, games, anime, videos, DVDs, cards, costumes, weaponry, scarves, pins, buttons, stickers, patches, animation cells, original art, and last but not least, comic books. Allow me to share my insightful insight, my wizened wisdom, and my humble observations with you regarding the phenomenon of America's Comic Con junkies. A true Comic Con junkie needs a fix at least once a month. Withdrawal symptoms can be a real downer.
Ah, I need a con! Gotta get a con!
As with all addicts, once you're hooked, you're hooked. It's sad, really. Once a normal human being, the con junkie is truly a lost soul.
I can't even think anymore.
Let me introduce Gem Mint Jerry. This guy is hardcore. He collects only mint items. I met Jerry at a con in Ohio 3 years ago. I was searching for old underground comics while Jerry was seeking supplies.
You idiot! You bumped your junk into my bags, boards, and boxes.
You bumped your junk into my comics! After we calmed down, apologies were exchanged, and we then immediately began talking comics. We walked around the con, checking out the sights, and shared stories of previous cons.
Way back in 79, I scored my Iron Man number one for $15. It was mint!
Lucky dog. Naturally, there's more than comics at a Comic-Con. There are actors and actresses, too. Some big-time stars can be found at Comic-Cons. Occasionally, however, sometimes the small-time stars sneak in. I was the teacup in my fourth grade school play. Believe it or not, you can be discovered at a Comic-Con. Lots of B-movie writers, producers, and casting agents are in attendance to meet and greet their hardcore fans. Jerry caught the acting bug 1 year. It took a while, but he worked up the nerve to approach a casting agent from a B-movie slasher flick.
Yeah, we're looking for extras. You say you'd like to play an old man or a bum? Perfect. You got a number?
Yeah, it's 313-555.
Artist Alley is a ton of fun, too. Many talented veteran artists and writers trek out every year to participate in the show and sign autographs, sketch on request, and meet their many fans. Fandom stars of tomorrow, such as Dave Nessler.
Hi, girls.
Matt Fizzell.
Have a day.
Sean Barry.
Brains.
For some odd reason, and I can't imagine why, Comic-Cons always attract pinup queens. I guess they enjoy the attention of drooling, stammering nerds.
Run along, kiddo. You're cramping my style.
Sorry.
Longtime fans know it's a good idea to eat a big meal before you get to the con. If you don't, sooner or later you'll find yourself at the mercy of the concession stand.
How much for a hot dog?
$6.50.
What about the onions, mustard, and relish?
That stuff is free.
Gimme that!
A Comic-Con is a great place to squeeze in a little people-watching kids. Interesting-looking folks hang at Comic-Cons. While it's true that nerds rule the herd, there are just as many diversified cats with varied collecting interests as there are genres of comic books. Let's scope out a few of these fantastic, fascinating, faithful, and fanatical fans.
Hi, I'm Wally. I collect small press comics.
I'm Mandy. I collect pop art funnies.
I'm Mr. Bentley. I collect mystery comics.
Hi, I'm Sonny Boy. I collect pre-code violent crime comics.
Hey, tone it down, guy.
Shut up.
A truly great comic book show will have a wide variety of professional comic dealers. Every Comic-Con junkie needs a dealer. You need comics? The dealer needs money. Lots and lots of your money.
Comics! Comics!
A really sharp dealer can sense your desperation. You have to learn how to play it cool so your transaction goes smoothly. A win-win relationship includes courtesy, manners, and respect.
Your selection is orderly, fairly priced, and highly collectible.
Once you've warmed up to the dealer through some craftily thought-out small talk, you then gently begin the art of haggling.
Say, friend, might I relieve you of this copy of Shock
Super Stories number one for, say, perhaps 10% off.
You seem like a nice guy. Yeah, okay, deal.
And so it goes. Hundreds of dollars change hands, each party satisfied with their exchange. Another great moment in the life of a Comic-Con junkie.
Yes!
Or was it? As you wheel and deal all the day long, skipping snacks and a meal, you sing the junkie song.
I'm a Comic-Con junkie. I live for paper and ink. Living a life of insanity. I believe I'm on the brink.
It's late on a Sunday. The clock strikes 5. The Comic-Con has ended. My God, you're still alive.
I got my comics.
Well, that's the story, folks. The true story of a Comic-Con junkie. Perhaps you know someone just like Jem Mint Jerry. Or quite possibly, this is your story. Whatever the case may be, keep this in mind. Reading is good for you. Any community that encourages its young people to read is where I want to be. Till next time, kids.
That was comic book writer Marty Herchek. He's based in Detroit. That piece was produced by Zach Rosen. To come, the Newbrella, the next generation in weather protection, and a former Cubs manager's infamous audio tape. Stay tuned. Got attuned to Sidetrack. All this snow and cold might have many thinking about getting away, maybe for a vacation to a ranch somewhere. Some computer programmers have done just that. They traveled about an hour south of Atlanta to spend a week at a dude ranch. But it's not the kind of place where guests ride horses or lounge in hot tubs. Independent producer Philip Greitzer has this story.
We're in the middle of a 14,000-acre nature preserve in middle Georgia, and inside a resort hotel, dappled by sunlight and surrounded by swaying pines, Aaron Hillegass teaches 17 tenderfoots about the complex beauty of software coding.
What the user chose. So we actually use a C function for this, and the C function is NS Run Alert Panel. You give it the title, you give it the text appear in the middle, and then you give it the name of the buttons. The one thing that surprises most people.
Welcome to the Big Nerd Ranch. Hillegas founded it 6 years ago so computer developers could focus on learning programming skills, far from outside distractions. Hillegas was the head trainer at Next and Apple. To programmers, he's kind of like Yoda, but taller. He says Big Nerd isn't so much a ranch as a kind of Zen hideaway.
Monks would retreat from the world so they could do their spiritual work in quiet and in a community. So I didn't think I could sell the Big Nerd Monastery. So we came up with the idea of the Big Nerd Ranch.
A couple of other companies offer similar training, but those are day-long seminars held in rented meeting rooms. Compared to that, the Big Nerd Ranch is like Club Med. From the moment developers arrive until they leave 6 days later, all nerd needs are attended to.
And the idea in a monastery is that prayers happen at a certain point and meals happen at a certain time, and there are no surprises because surprises would be distracting from what you're there for. So we always make every day exactly the same, and everyone knows what's going to happen after the first day.
The ranch's logo is a 10-gallon hat with a pinwheel on top. But at the Big Nerd Ranch, you won't find horses, or any other ranch activities, really. There wouldn't be time. Nerds spend 12-hour days mastering computer application tools while munching cookies and downing unlimited Mountain Dews. At 8:30, 12:30, and 6:30, there's plenty of time to discuss computer applications some more over buffet meals. And every day, precisely at 2 o'clock, there's a nature walk. Standard topic of conversation, computer applications.
Is it possible to have like constant voice recognition software running in the background of your computer and still be able to use your computer?
Yes, well, there's a telephone.
And a speech recognizer.
It costs $3,500 for the week-long course, but most students' employers pick up the tab. We're talking big companies like Apple, Google, or General Dynamics. The payoff is programmers who can design bigger and better software. Well, better anyway. Ashley Hotgraver is working on a not-so-big program she calls Eggminder.
You put in how many eggs you eat per day, and then you put in how many eggs you have in your fridge, and it'll tell you, it'll advise when you need to buy eggs.
For students, of course, the real payoff is a chance to commune with their nerd brothers and sisters. Patrick Usser works for a California sound production company.
I was attracted by the whole idea of just being able to get away for about a week at a time. You know, I mean, you can go out and you can buy a book, but it's not the same thing as being around a bunch of people who, you know, share the same interest. And you can start talking to somebody about stupid things, like talking to about something that interested me about the Spotlight API.
Spotlight API, by the way, is an application tool. Okay, so it's not exactly singing cowboy songs around the campfire. But for nerds, this kind of thing makes them feel at home on the range. In Pine Mountain, Georgia, I'm Philip Gratzer.
This is Sidetrack I'm sure this has happened to you. You're walking with an umbrella in a storm and a wind gust hits you. Your umbrella turns inside out. This, according to inventor Alan Kaufman, was what inspired him to rethink the classic umbrella design. What he came up with was something that looks like a plastic bubble you wear over your head. He calls it the Nubrella, and he hopes it will change the way people think about umbrellas. I talked with Kaufman recently and asked him first to describe the Nubrella and explain how it's different than the standard design.
Well, it differs probably in a bunch of ways. I think that the major flaw with the traditional umbrella, as most people know, is the problem with wind and the fact that they invert and they're very difficult to manage in the wind. So the first distinguish is that this thing is designed aerodynamically, where the wind flows over and around this canopy with an extended material down in front, so it completely denies the opportunity for it to invert.
Well, describe it for us. What does it look like?
It's kind of like an oval design. Almost think of like a bicycle helmet that's extended with longer sides. So it's kind of oval, where the canopy kind of goes down to about your shoulders on the front, back, and sides. So, think of it as like a little cutting into the wind where there's no flat surface that much for the wind to kind of hit.
Umbrella technology really hasn't changed in hundreds, probably thousands of years. Why change it now? What was your inspiration for this?
There was no inspiration, I'll be honest with you. I was in New York City in my prior business in one of my wireless stores, and it was a miserable, miserable rainy day outside one day, and I was just looking outdoors and watching people as they struggled with their umbrellas, and out of nowhere, this image just came to me. I never planned on it, nothing, and I just decided to jot down that image because I thought it was kind of unique. And that was it. Put it away for about a month and then decided to pick it up and see what I had there and pursue it.
Talk a little bit more about this hands-free umbrella and the technology used to make it happen.
The hands-free kind of came later down the road as the design. We take the pole out of the middle, which is another distinguishing point, because you want to be in the middle. That's where the maximum coverage is. So with an offset handle in the front, we needed to stabilize the kind of the weight of the even though it's very light. So we had these shoulder supports that just rest on your shoulder and you hold it in the front, and if you let it go, it would rest on your kind of like your stomach, and it could be hands-free. But then I said, I want to get this completely hands-free where it really won't move. So we developed another strap that goes from the back to the front, that's optional, that goes under your arm, so it completely locks it in. You don't even really feel it, and now it's a complete hands-free umbrella that could even be hands-free in 30-mile-an-hour winds.
Well, in your press release, you talk about the retro look of the Nubrella. It does have a very mod look to it. What was the inspiration for that, or was it intentional?
I don't think so. Again, it just goes back to creating an aerodynamic product that, like any other product that deals with the wind, they kind of have this aerodynamic look. And then with the clear plastic, it kind of goes back to the retro of maybe you remember the bubble umbrella in the 60s, and I think that's where we're picking up on the retro kind of look to it.
Now, also in your press release, you talk about the, quote, the suggested impact of global warming has caused consumers to desire better products when facing forceful storms, chilling cold, and severe weather conditions, end quote. You kind of implied that the Nubrella is the first step in a more advanced weather protection system. Now, are we going to be walking around in giant bubbles someday?
Well, I think it's unique that the only weather protection device that we really have out there is an umbrella. And if you think about the umbrella, it really doesn't protect you against all the elements. For instance, cold weather. And we don't walk around in ski masks anymore and how bitter cold it can get, but people still suffer with no real protection. This device actually steps further than just participation and offers some protection against cold weather and wind. So I think it's more of a technological device that's going to offer more weather protection than just the umbrella.
It's a rather large device. How big is it exactly, and how does it compare to, you know, regular umbrellas, size-wise?
It's not as actually big in terms of width and everything. It's probably a slight smaller on the size, which is great for the busy sidewalks of like Manhattan, where you don't have to do the bobbing effect. So it's more streamlined.
So how does it compare to other umbrellas?
Well, if you compare it to a mini umbrella, you know, the small, there's two sizes of umbrellas, what I consider the mini and the so-called golf. It's certainly adequate, if not better, than the mini umbrella in terms of the size and the protection it will provide you. Certainly a golf umbrella is going to provide a little bit bigger canopy that will offer a little bit more protection, but then you have the complications of when wind is around and the size of it, and it's pretty difficult to manage when the wind does get a hold of it. So I think this is almost like taking the umbrella, like I've said, almost into the 21st century, where it needed to be kind of evolved to the umbrella. It's never really evolved.
You mentioned a second ago golf umbrellas, the big golf umbrellas. Are you expecting people to play golf or sports wearing the new umbrella?
Well, I don't think you physically could hit some balls with it, but I don't think anybody would ever play golf in it unless they wanted to chip and putt in the rain. But, it's really not designed for that. I think more for sports enthusiasts, it will be a major spectator item. You could, when you're sitting watching a sports outdoors, you have to hold your arm up in the air for an hour and a half or 2 hours. Here you can stand completely hands-free, drink a cup of coffee, or talk on the phone, actually. I really see it being a real viable solution for sporting stadiums. As you watch football games and blizzards and everything, umbrellas are barred in stadiums. And we feel this could be a product that solves that problem, where you could take it into stadiums. It wouldn't affect the people around you, and more importantly, it has no sharp points that cause injury, and that's why umbrellas are barred in stadiums.
Now, I assume you field tested the new umbrella. What sorts of reactions do you get from people when they see this on the street and people walking around wearing this?
There is no doubt that almost every set of eyes will look at you. It's just a different device, as you see, and everyone's going to look at you. I have worn it in New York many, many times, and most of the reaction I get is, "That's cool." That's probably the number one phrase that I get from people. That's what they'll say is, "That's cool."
Who is the new umbrella aimed at? What's your target audience?
I think it's a wide audience at the end of the day. Originally, because it was designed for wind, we think of the big metropolitan cities because they deal with the skyscrapers that cause much more wind tunnels. But now we're seeing, even in rural America, anyone that's housewives that are going to a soccer game to watch their kids play in the snow, it's a product that you can stand hands-free and keep warmer. So I think the fact of the warmer and the hands-free brings in so many more elements. You can actually ride a bike with this completely hands-free, and it works excellent. And maybe not in this country, but a lot of people in other countries don't own cars, and they commute to and from school, work on bikes. And this is a perfect solution for them.
When I was looking at pictures of the new umbrella, it's made for a single person. And there's a certain romance about sharing an umbrella with someone. There's been songs written about it, stories written about it. Do you feel the new umbrella loses some of that romance?
I would say yes, to that extent. But I've always saw my product as almost a new line item to the world, where everybody that owned my product would also own a basic, what I call, mini umbrella. For the regular light rain days, my product may be a little overkill for that day. Who knows? So those may be the romantic days. But when it gets pretty miserable out, I don't think people are going to be too concerned with, romance when the conditions get pretty harsh.
Are you thinking about a new umbrella built for two?
It's a possibility. We've actually have some photographs with two in there, and I certainly see other variations of this product coming. We're certainly going to do a children's product that we've had huge demand for because of the safety factor, taking away all the sharp points. But I definitely see this product evolving further. We've even had people ask if they could put speakers in there to play their iPod. So I see it definitely evolving.
If people are interested in the new umbrella, where can they find information about it or get one if they want one?
Well, right now, all the information is at newbrella.com, and that's where you actually can purchase it. It's not available in stores yet. Actually, a Chicago company picked it up. Hamaka Schlemmer is going to have it in their Father's Day catalog in a few months. But we have not reached out to distribution as of yet.
That was Alan Kaufman, inventor of the new umbrella. You're listening to Sidetrack. Spring training is underway for the Chicago Cubs in Mesa, Arizona. The 2008 season marks 100 years since the last Cubs World Series championship. It's also the anniversary of another remarkable moment for the team. 25 years since former manager Lee Elia let a stream of expletives flow from his mouth right into a tape recorder. Sam Hudzik has more.
It was late April 1983. A handful of reporters gathered in Lee Elia's office at Wrigley Field. The Cubs had just suffered a tough loss to the Dodgers, their 14th loss in the season's first 19 games. And Elia was angry, not at his players, at Cubs fans.
What the f*** am I supposed to do? Go out there and let my f***ing players get destroyed every day and be quiet about it for the f***ing nickel-dime people to show up? The mother f***ing...
The version of the tape widely available on the internet continues like that for a good 3 minutes. Elia drops about 50 swear words, give or take.
85% of the world's working. The other 15 come out here.
The Cubs were expected to do well that year, and some fans didn't take the disappointment lightly. As the players walked up the third base line to what was then the entrance to the locker room,
fans started throwing stuff and cussing out Keith Moreland, Larry Boa.
That's Les Grobstein, a sports reporter at the time for WLS Radio, who recorded the famous rant. Grobstein says when he and the other reporters started asking Elia about the game, he went off.
He was defending his players. He was defending his players and going to bat for him, and the players enjoyed the fact that he was backing them up. He had their back.
I made some remarks that I swear to Almighty God, why they came out of my mouth, I have no idea because I've never said them before or since.
That's Lee Elia, now 70 years old. He wants to make it clear he wasn't angry at all Cubs fans, just those harassing his players.
It'll never be digested in the other way than it sounds, and probably rightfully so because I said what I said. The only thing that bothers me is that I never, ever would decimate the love and what the fans of Chicago are to the Chicago Cubs. That's the thing that bothers me the most.
Elia wasn't immediately fired after the tirade. He apologized at a press conference that night. The team actually started to play well for a while before hitting a skid in August. That's when Elia lost his job.
I am sure that if you had a gathering of Cub fans at a banquet and you introduced Lee Elia, he would get a very warm reception. Now, you know, all these years later.
Lester Munson is a longtime Cubs fan and Chicago-based journalist who works for ESPN. Munson says the tape's a part of the loony history associated with the team and baseball personalities in general.
You get a bunch of baseball writers together, they will play tapes of Tommy Lasorda, Lee Elia's tirade, and various other things that they carry around with them. It's amazing to me.
But to a whole generation of web surfers who couldn't tell Lee Elia from Don Zimmer, the recording is just a funny addition to their MP3 collections. And to Elia, that reality, that's crushing.
After 49 years in baseball and having been a part of a world championship club and a coach in an all-star game and having managed two major league clubs and having been to postseason five times, you would think that maybe there was something else to remember Lee Elia about than just one tough afternoon in Chicago.
But he says he still has good feelings about Chicago and good thoughts about Cubs fans.
I mean, God knows. I mean, if there's one pure thing in this industry, it is the fans of Chicago.
And 25 years after that day he'd rather forget, Lee Elia's still in the game. He's down in Arizona this week for spring training, an on-field consultant for the Seattle Mariners. I'm Sam Hudzik.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.